We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.
And welcome to Dads on the Air for Tuesday, the 11th of August, 2009. We have a very interesting show today, mainly episodes or articles from the we played a couple of weeks ago, Amphitars. Today we'll be covering Give Dog a Bone Part 2. We had Part 1 on about a fortnight ago. We also have Everyday Family Terrorism, Wages of Spin and Domestic Violence. So we look forward to hearing from those. Unfortunately, today there is only me in the studio, so we'll just get through it the best we can. Now, let's go to the news. To start off with the news, we have an article here in the Herald Sun, Melbourne's Herald Sun, dated 28th of July 2009, and the headline reads, "Divorce is bad for your health," by Georgie Pilcher. Divorce has a huge impact on your health, even if you remarry, a study has found. Divorce or widowed people have 20% more chronic health conditions such as heart disease, diabetes and cancer than married people, and also suffer more mobility problems such as having trouble climbing stairs and walking. Research to be published in the Journal of Health and Social Behaviour reveals that interviews with more than 8,000 people found they entered adulthood with a stock of health, and each time a person divorced or was widowed, they lost a chunk, putting them at risk of chronic illness. The Chicago University study found divorcees who didn't remarry suffered the greatest ill health due to a drop in income and a rise in stress related to shared childcare and possibly custody issues. So I guess that shows that certainly there are health issues in regards to divorce and separation. Our next story is dated the 9th of August. It's from the Sydney Morning Herald, and its headline reads, "Rough Justice, Fear in Family Court Blitz." It's by Joel Gibson, who is the legal affairs reporter, and he writes, "The family court will fly judges to Sydney from four other states for a September blitz in an attempt to clear a backlog of 30 of its most difficult cases. But the exercise has sparked fears of hasty, second-rate justice in disputes that determine the economic and emotional well-being of children and their families. The cases, some more than 4 years old, have built up after five judges left the court's busiest registry and only one was replaced. During the planned special sitting, the cases will be dispatched over a three-week period with the help of judges from Brisbane, Adelaide, Canberra and Melbourne. But some lawyers will not be able to represent their clients in years-old cases because of clashes in the compressed timetable. One barrister said many were trying to get out of the chaotic exercise, which would produce very rough justice. This scheme is hugely unpopular with the profession, the clients, and I think probably most of the judges. I know at least one of them has said it won't work." Lee Stubbs, the coordinator for family law at Turner Freeman, said he had cases that would clash. He would be forced to hand off clients to other lawyers. "Can you imagine if we solved the health system's problems by saying, you can't have that doctor you want? You know, we're going to get doctors from all over Australia and then give them 24 hours notice for your procedure." So it sounds pretty chaotic there at the family court. They're trying to get rid of these, or I suppose not get rid of, but, you know, look at these 30 cases, and obviously they're difficult cases. Difficult cases, it will obviously, you know, take a lot of time, a lot of effort to get through. I wonder how much these magistrates will have time to actually read through the case history and stuff, because obviously these cases have been going on for many years. So let's just hope they do it right, because as the article says, you know, the ones that really miss out if the decision is wrong is the children. So, yeah, we'll move on from that. an article in the Courier Mail by Matthew Fiennes Clinton, Dad's Hit Out Over Shared Parenting Law Review Choice. Fathers groups have blasted the Rudd's government's appointment of a retired family court judge to examine shared parenting laws he has openly criticised previously. There are concerns that Richard Chisholm has already made up his mind to recommend ditching the controversial legislation. Ed Dabrowski, the federal director of the Shared Parenting Council, says, "I believe the government wants to change the law to satisfy the radical feminists and other extreme groups that might want to roll back shared parenting." And Richard Chisholm has already indicated his resistance for shared parenting. That's why he brought it in. The government has a preordained agenda. In an inappropriate appointment, he will give the result they want. Professor Chisholm emphasised yesterday that he would had been asked to review how the family court deals with allegations of violence. However, the University of Sydney honorary professor in law acknowledged that this issue and the shared parenting laws were linked. So there's another article there. In The Age, Melbourne, 29th of July by Carol Nader. The headline reads, "Court lets children and mother hide from father. The family court has granted a woman and her two children permission effectively to go into hiding and change their identity to escape their violent, abusive and controlling former partner. In a rare ruling, the court upheld the woman's complaints that she and her children had endured a history of domestic violence and that the family court could move away from their home in Tasmania to anywhere in Australia." You know, there's cases like this everywhere in regards to fathers that just find it too difficult to get access to their children, and unfortunately they do these silly things. Silly as they are, I can understand it to some extent, because it's just the love of their children, and that's what's important. And I guess they're just trying to continue to be able to share that love with their children. So with that, that's the news. We'll be back in just a moment with the Amphitars.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
Hello, this is Amfortas again with part two of my podcast called Give a Dog a Bad Name and Expect to Get Bitten. In part one, I gave a lot of detail from contemporary research which shows the systematic destruction of masculine reputation foisted on us by an anti-male media driven by the education women receive from our universities. Men are rubbished and calumnized daily. Good men, ordinary hard-working men, family men. The good name of men is soiled at every opportunity by ordinary women repeating feminist agitprop. Women have eagerly adopted the habit of disrespecting men, making it a sardonic sport, so much so that even an early feminist like Doris Lessing is horrified at the destructiveness, callousness, crudity, and downright lies. What can men do about it? What are men doing about it? Men are generally doers rather than talkers, present company excepted, and when good men stop doing what good men do, women lose out. Anthony Nazzaro, writing for the National Organization of Men, has pointed to incidents, behavioral trends. Let's look at some. The Baltic Sea. Estonian-Swedish ferry sinks. Over 800 people die. A disproportionate number of women drown. Many say that the law of the sea, women and children first, was forgotten, and law of the jungle, every man for himself, prevailed. The screams of women drowning were heard by many men, it was reported. Montreal, Canada. 14 women students were killed by a mentally disturbed man. Many media commentators were bothered by the fact that male students didn't risk their lives in an attempt to protect the women. Feminists use this as yet another male-bashing exercise. They have an annual protest accusing those boys and all men of being complicit. New York City, the Twin Tower bombings. In the panic to get out of the buildings, some women reported of being shoved out of elevators by men. One or two of the 300-odd firemen who died in the inferno, perhaps. Was it the actual case that women were pushed out? Maybe it was just a whine from a woman or two who broke a heel. But men were criticised in a tragedy. On the radio in the UK, a lost child, a little girl, is reported as found wandering the aisles of a businessman's train from Glasgow. Women phoned in condemning men on the train for not helping the child. Their tone is heated, bordering on calls for lynching. The many business women passengers who did not help are not mentioned. A small girl wanders from a kindergarten in England. She drowns in a pond. A manhunt looks for a van seen in the area. The man is found and cleared, but is vilified for not stopping to help a wandering child. He says, "I was afraid to talk to a strange child and be accused of being a pedophile." In the book Male and Female, A Study of the Sexes in a Changing World, there appears an opinion that men have to learn to want to provide and protect others. And this behaviour being learned is fragile and can disappear rather easily under social conditions that no longer teach it or deride it. Phyllis Schlafly, a well-known American writer, has written that male soldiers are now being trained to disregard female soldiers' pain and suffering if captured. Since the sexual assault of a US female POW during the Gulf War, who turned out not to have been sexually assaulted at all, by the way, she is afraid if this attitude gets out into the general public, it could be devastating to male-female relationships. Well, it has, and it is. Destroying chivalry by continually criticising it and blaming men for being polite and helpful is one thing. But are women willing to forfeit the paternal feeling that most men still have for them? Ow, now there is a provocative word. But when did feminists ever keep to real meanings of words? Paternalistic used to be a positive word, rubbished by feminists. Many men are no longer more outraged by women being abused than by men being abused. Today, men are starting to refuse to see themselves as the providers and protectors of women. In an equal world, why should they be? The provider-protector role, we are told, is oppressive. This archetypal male role has been rubbished by feminists and their legions of media whores and legislators. Women are hardly noted for stirring themselves to provide for and protect men. Quite the opposite, in fact. Every opportunity to abandon men is taken, as Doris Lessing pointed out in disgust at her feminist sisters. Women can take back the night on the one-way streets all they like. Feminist legal scholar and harpy, Professor Catherine MacKinnon, has said that the increase in domestic violence and rape are symptomatic of male attitude towards women. Ha! She would say that, wouldn't she? What increase? Listeners may like to get a transcript of this podcast with its footnotes and citations, proving her not only completely wrong, but deliberately so. She speaks absolute nonsense. There has been a consistent decrease in domestic violence and rape against women in all Western countries. It is women's domestic violence and false allegations of rape which has seen a marked increase. More lies and vilification from the women's studies departments infecting our universities and our legal system. But then, what can one expect from such a rabid liar as Professor MacKinnon? She emulates Professor Mary Koss, who fabricated the infamous and ubiquitous 1 in 4 women raped statistic by deliberately falsifying self-selected data collected through the feminist Ms. magazine. Despite being exposed and torn apart by Christina Hoff Sommers in her book Who Stole Feminism, there is barely a women's magazine in circulation that has not continued to repeat this wicked lie to terrify its readers and turn them against decent men. Liars, men haters. Women professors of lies are to be found in every Australian university too. Professors whose careers have been made as rent-seeking scum, founded on the most outrageous personal and professional falsity. Could feminism's agitprop gender politics, designed to suborn women, have changed men's attitudes so that men now see men and women as just people? Have feminists pushed women off the pedestal? Perhaps they have opened men's eyes to an historical confidence trick. Is this a good condition for our society? According to a recent poll, many fewer men would give up their seats in a lifeboat to a woman today. Quite a difference from the 1912 Titanic disaster, where mostly women were saved, even more than children. In a riot, disaster or war, will it mean every man and woman for themselves? Many men today demand that women be obligated for the draft and combat along with men. Mel Fite of the National Center for Men in the USA has stated that a male body isn't any more capable of withstanding a bullet than a female body. Women hold political office and boardroom positions and are police officers, and some are even firefighters. Why should men still risk their lives to protect them? Geraldo Rivera, on a show regarding male-female violence, stated, "The way I was brought up, men should always protect women." But isn't this attitude patronising and demeaning? Feminists tell everyone it is, taking every opportunity to berate men. Some women call this equally respectful attitude misogynistic. What a friggin' nerve! Some men call this result of societal equality poetic justice. If being equally respected is what women want, then perhaps women could make a start on being respectful and change history. And her story, while they're at it. They have had several generations of feminism and equality, but seem yet to make that start. Meanwhile, being equally disrespected could be a natural and inevitable byproduct of their systematic disdain, even if backfiring on women. It seems to me that to stop this rot in society, and specifically the media law-sponsored forced redundancy of men, will need a revolution in society, maybe brought about by a calamity. If, say, an invasion was to occur, and men were to turn their backs on the defence of the nation, as we are now redundant, what would the prevailing attitude of the female gender be then? If such an invading force was one that sees women as nothing more than chattels to be used, abused, and discarded at whim, would we then see men as good for something? Ah, yes, we would be good at defending the freedoms and advancements that these women claim that they have gained for themselves. This shows that the claims of the feminazis have made in respect to the advancement of women are nothing without the men to protect and ensure those gains. They are only guaranteed existence by a willingness of men to uphold them. But why should men stand up and defend the rights of the feminazis and their followers, who label men as redundant, violent, abusive, child abusers, perverts, rapists, etc., as they are fond of vomiting in the mainstream media? Remember the feminist catchphrase, "All men are rapists." Perhaps it will never come to be that men will, en masse, turn their backs in such a situation, as we all have mothers, sisters, daughters, and female relatives whom we hold dear to our hearts. But even these are increasingly disrespecting men, divorcing and dispossessing their husbands, and estranging themselves and their children from their fathers. Children, particularly girls, are developing an horrendous image of men, starting with their fathers. They will grow totally distrustful of men altogether. Boys' self-esteem is terrible as they look to a future when they too will become the men they see portrayed. There is a self-fulfilling prophecy bearing down on us. 80% of divorces are initiated by wives wanting to rid themselves of the men Doris Lessing spoke about. Nice men, intelligent men, kind men. These men are deliberately mislabeled and dragged into the family court, sometimes by policemen who have thrown them out of their homes on false allegation. Men are dispossessed of their homes and their families in the best interest of children. Adolf Hitler's wicked phrase. It is not only men's image that is ruined. Men just might leave all women to themselves. It will not be from anger. Despite being so mistreated, men in general have not shown anger toward women. But men are feeling profoundly disappointed, disillusioned, and disgusted. Western women have not raised any objection to being manipulated by feminism. Instead, they have embraced its seductive, destructive mantras and mendacities. They punish faultless men who they see as all the same, all bad. They have permitted calumny and few have raised objection like Doris Lessing. They have chosen to follow a pernicious and socially destructive Marxist-feminist agitprop path to a bed of their own making that they have to lie in, alone. No doubt they will blame men for being commitment-phobic. Thank you for listening, and I hope it has given you some food for thought, especially the women who might have bothered to listen to a mere man. Please pass a link to this podcast and its first part to a friend or two. My thanks also go to men's rights activist Christian Jay for his production assistance and to the activism group at antimisandry.com for their suggestions. I dedicate this podcast to my estranged daughter, for whom I grieve, and my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased. Ask, who does the Grail serve?
Indeed, who does the Grail serve? Very interesting stuff there on part two, give a dog a bad name. You know, it opens up a lot of stuff for myself and obviously for our listeners. It seems to be that, you know, it's a really confusing time in society to be a man at the moment. You're sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't. You know, do you open a door for a lady anymore? Is that seen to be polite or is that seen to be sexist? You know, do you help a child in distress? As you said, you know, there are some people in the community that will want to point fingers and say, you know, is that a pedophile helping out that child? What's his ulterior motives, et cetera, et cetera. It's really gotten really, really bad. I guess, you know, for me personally, the only thing I can say is that, you know, I do things from my heart. If I believe it to be right, I do it. I don't care what other people think. I don't care what other people say. It's just the way I am. You know, another really interesting part in that is he stated that 80% of wives initiate divorce. We certainly come across that. As our regular listeners know, I'm the coordinator for Dads in Distress. I deal with a lot of fathers and men going through the separation process. And yes, certainly roughly 4 out of 5 of those men actually say that they didn't see it coming. The wife initiated it. They're certainly in the dark, you know. And what happens there is, you know, from studies that have shown that, you know, the wife has actually had this worked out 6 months, 9 months, 12 months before, and as she's gone through all her emotional stuff, you know, while they were still in the marriage. She's reconciled herself, she's sorted herself out, and she's made the decision that, you know, the marriage is over. And then all of a sudden it's up to the dad or the man in the situation to try and get over that emotional stuff, because, you know, mum's already at a different level. She's already ready to you know, separate, go to court, all that stuff, whereas dad's just in limbo because he didn't see it coming. You know, he's too busy out there working, doing what he had considered was the best thing, which was providing for his family, you know, doing the age-old thing of, you know, being a provider and doing that to the best of his capabilities. So it is very difficult. And then on top of that, you have all the, as was said in the podcast also, all the issues with false allegations, you know, and not only what that does on a personal level, but also what it does on a societal level, in the sense that more and more and more often men are being, I guess, slated with the same brush, which is that we're all perpetrators. And it's wrong, and it's not right, and it's incorrect. And with that, I think we'll go to Man Agony. We'll be back in a moment.
so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1-300-853-437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And welcome back. That was Goulburn Street Hall from the album Man Agony, not Man Agony itself. So I apologise for that. Next, we have the next instalment of the podcasts. And this one is titled Everyday Family Terrorism.
Hello, I am Amfortas, and today I want to talk about everyday family terrorism. First, though, I want to acknowledge my colleague Paul Elam from Houston, Texas, who collaborated with me in providing this short talk. There's two authors' heads on this note, although he did most of the writing whilst I do all the talking. And there are two sides to every coin, to coin a phrase. There are at least two sides to every coined aphorism. Let's take a look at one such expression from both sides of the coin before I run out of monetary metaphors. If mama ain't happy, nobody's happy. Use that expression in public and you'll get a lot of good-natured laughter and nods of the head, some sardonic smiles perhaps. It applies to not a few mamas. Underneath the humour and agreement is something we all know is a little darker. There are women this doesn't apply to, of course. They take their knocks in life in pretty good stride, shaking off disappointment with grace and a healthy amount of humility. They have my respect, unlike mama. And there are also a few men who can't get through 5 minutes of everyday life without subjecting everyone to their complaints du jour. They too are a pain. What I'm talking about here is the idea that when something displeases you, everyone around you has to suffer for it. Not just listen to it, but pay for it. The legal tender for this transaction is usually the common peace. You'll have peace when and only when mama is satisfied. In more extreme cases, it means nothing less than abusive control. This is more about women than men. Most coined phrases get sent to the mint with at least a morsel of truth to them. This one wasn't issued with daddy's name on it. Women who hold their marriages and families hostage to their desires and whims, when they are even willing to admit to their actions, have the same litany of excuses and rationalizations. If I don't run things, they won't get done. Or, if I don't run things my way, hey, they won't get done right. As a matter of fact, you can think of the if I don't line and fill in the blank with any number of imagined disasters that will occur if mama's way isn't done right now. And pity the fool that gets in her way, even authorities, because mama will up the ante as much as is necessary to ensure compliance, up to and including dissolution and destruction of the family altogether. Of course, this begs the question, what is the morality of anyone so bent on such uncontrolled drive to control? I'd argue that the moral foundation of these women is as solid as balsa wood and twice as porous. But it has the effect of sharp steel when wielded in the family and in the family court. The damage these women inflict on those around them has been well documented. Erin Pitsey, a fine and honest and empathetic woman who founded the world's first battered women's shelters in 1971, dedicated her life to the study of domestic violence and the study of women in violent families. Her ultimate findings, although scientifically sound, were less than politically correct. That explains why few have heard of her or her work. In fact, feminists threatened her life for speaking the truth and drove her out of the women's shelters she created. Guess what sort of women run them now? Erin relates in her 1988 book, The Emotional Terrorist and the Violence Prone. The family of the emotional terrorist, she says, may well be characterized as violent, incestuous, dysfunctional, and unhappy, but it is the terrorist or tyrant who is primarily responsible for initiating conflict, imposing histrionic outbursts upon otherwise calm situations, or more subtly and invisibly, quietly manipulating other family members into uproar through guilt, cunning taunts, and barely perceived provocations. She goes on to say, the quiet, manipulative terrorist is usually the most undetected terrorist. Through the subtle creation of perpetual turmoil, this terrorist may drive other family members to alcoholism, to drug addiction, to explosive behavior, to suicide. The other family members, therefore, are often misperceived as the family problem, and the hidden terrorist seen as the saintly woman who puts up with it all. If this sounds familiar, it is because Pitts's emotional terrorist is just an extreme illustration of a not-so-uncommon behaviour in so many women. She can be Mrs. Anyone, your Mrs. or you. Dr. Eric Byrne described these and the several games that typify dysfunctional people and families, and with a predominantly female locus, in his capital little book, The Games People Play. He described the general features of such games, such as mayhem, his uproar, where any number of family members can be drawn into hysterical collapse, and rapo, where the man in particular is falsely accused of some sexual transgression invented for the purpose and causing offence or hurt feeling, neither of which have any observable proof as corroboration. Or worse, it can be extended with a few handy laws to encompass the worst and most varied game of all, the let's you and him fight game, in which the local police are called in to inflict severe damage to the victimized family. The father is taken away, often in handcuffs, leaving the children completely defenseless. The judges refuse to see Mama for what she is and dispossesses Daddy altogether. Solutions are not simple. Having counseled many families affected by emotional terrorism, both Paul and I can tell you that getting through the denial of such women is a challenge. Often the other victims in the family defend her with miscalled chivalry. Family members of domestic terrorists are often so beaten down and servile that they share the woman's denial. They perceive her just as Pitsy described, the saintly woman who puts up with it all. Confronting Mama makes her really unhappy. It doesn't take Sigmund Freud to figure out who will pay for it when the session is over. It ain't her. Mama and most women like her can't stand the idea that there might be something wrong with them morally, or even that they may simply be wrong. When her misbehavior is explained and described to her, accurately, objectively, and calmly, she often resorts to denial, anger, redirection of blame, and, of course, the new approved fallback position, victimhood. No, solutions to problems like this are not simple. The denial of the domestic terrorist is reinforced by the collective denial that most of society shares about the nature and behaviour of women in the first place. One good place to start is in each of us. It doesn't mean criticising all women, but it doesn't mean holding all women to higher standards than is currently the social norm. Simple truth would be a good place to start. Women who undermine their marriages and families for the sake of controlling them are far from funny. Sniggering at their behavior is like finding something funny about a man that pummels his wife because she burned the toast. Many people of both sexes take the attitude that however women act, that is the way they are. Accept me as I am, is their mantra. But that is an enabling fantasy. We give them a pass on almost anything, no matter how egregiously appalling, and seldom think of who we are damaging by doing so. Domestic emotional terrorists have gone undetected and unaddressed, bringing harm to themselves, their children and spouses, and the culture as a whole. When society, that is you and I, raises its standards, women will likely do the same. If we don't all work together on this, women and men both, matters will get worse. This has been Amfortas. I thank Paul Elam for his wise words, and I thank Christian Jay for his production assistance. I dedicate this to my estranged but beloved daughter, and to my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased. Ask, who does the Grail serve?
Indeed, who does the Grail serve? From Amfortas. Very interesting stuff there. Very heartfelt stuff, obviously, too. We'll go to a track. This is Joe Cocker, and I think we can all get something from this. We'll get by with a little help from our friends.
Do you need anybody? bless you.
And God bless you, Joe.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And welcome back. We're back with the next section of Amphitars. And this one is called Wages of Spin.
Hello, I am Amphitars, and today I want to talk to you, women and men both, about the wages of spin. It is about money and about lies. My talk, written by Paul Ellum, a writer and men's advocate from Houston in Texas, is about pay equity. It is one of the last battles in a gender war that started with women's suffrage in the 19th century and raged throughout the 1960s and 70s. Unfortunately, it is a battle that continues for naught. Politicians with no truths to say trot out this canard every year. But ladies, you are being deliberately deceived and made angry for your vote. All the fighting is predicated on the notion that women earn less than men do for the same work. Depending on who you listen to, the actual numbers vary. Back in the 70s, feminists wore 59-cent pins to protest the fact that a woman earned only 59 cents for every dollar earned by a man. They also protested the glass ceiling, claiming that women were shut off from the highest rungs on the professional ladder. The stats are almost right. Men do earn more than women. But that surface reality is clarified when you take a deeper look into the pond. The numbers are based on a raw average of men's and women's income. Thus, a female receptionist who works 40 hours per week has her income averaged in with the male CEO of the company she works for, who works 70 hours per week. Different? Yes. Sex-based discrimination? Hardly. But that is the implication people are given when the faulty methodology that the wage studies use to reach faulty conclusions is intentionally hidden. That is what happened in the 60s and 70s, and what is happening now. In April of 2007, the feminists' American Association of University Women released a study with the following conclusion in the executive summary. 1 year out of college, it said, women working full-time earn only 80% as much as their male colleagues earn. 10 years after graduation, women fall further behind, earning only 69% as much as men earn. So according to the AAUW, women have gone from a 59-cent wage gap to a 69-cent wage gap. But there remains one fundamental problem. The methodology hasn't changed. Please note the very next line from the executive summary. Controlling for hours, it says, occupation, parenthood, and other factors normally associated with pay, college-educated women still earn less than their male peers. Note that they did not say, after controlling for hours and other factors, that women still earned only 69 cents, but they earned less. In other words, they presented their conclusions so that unsubstantiated statistics would be remembered and passed on to others. It was a clear act of deception, a distortion, fabricated and marketed as science in order to pursue an invalid political agenda. It is deception and a set of bogus figures that are repeated in legislatures in most Anglophile countries by Harriet Harman in the UK and Julia Gillard in Australia, for instance, and Nancy Pelosi in the USA. These are powerful political feminist women who have never experienced a glass ceiling in their lives and are paid far more than 99% of men. They are on the highest rungs they claim women are prevented from reaching. Lies seem to fall easily from their lips into the other women's ears for deceptively garnered votes. They have dirty hands, but not from hard work. Naturally, the question arises, if feminist studies are distorting the facts, then what is the truth? June O'Neill, former director of the United States Congressional Budget Office, conducted a study of the wage gap allegations. She found, after controlling for experience, education, and number of hours, years on the job, that women earned 98% of what their male counterparts earned. That is a wage gap of 98 cents to the dollar, or what most statisticians would say is statistically insignificant, or within a suitable margin of error to call equal. This is what the feminist university women should have concluded, and would have, if they were in the slightest interest in disseminating accurate information. But the truth about the wage gap myth undermines the feminist agenda, to paint women as victims to the male-dominated workplace. Understand that the AAUW and other similar feminist organisations use these results to raise funds and put themselves in the media limelight. If there is no problem, and there isn't, then there is no need to give them money or even to pay attention to them. While feminists maintain that feminism is about empowering women, we all too often see that their agenda depends on making victims of them, even if those victims need to be fabricated. We can and should dig into this some more. It is important to understand much more about why studies indicate a wage gap before the statistics are clarified by considering the variables that affect the outcome. Dr. Warren Farrell, PhD, the only man ever elected to the National Organisation for Women's National Board of Directors 3 times, was one of the early feminists incensed at the alleged pay gap. Dr. Farrell dedicated a great deal of his life to challenging the culture to address this injustice. Then one fateful day, he asked himself questions that would change the course of his life, and eventually convince him to leave that organisation, reportedly to the relief of his feminist peers. He thought, wait a minute, if women actually earn only 59 cents for every dollar earned by a man for the same work, why wouldn't companies only hire women? Wouldn't they be able to produce products much cheaper than companies that employ men and put the competition out of business? He spent the next several years in painstaking research of the subject and came to the conclusion that has been verified as many times as it has been ignored. Women make less money because of their choices, not because of discrimination. When given the choice between more money or a better quality of life, women are much more likely than men to choose quality of life. Women work fewer hours per week than men on average, take more time off, and frequently choose to put family and personal life ahead of their jobs. This speaks to women's intelligence and empathy and nurture, much more than it does to their alleged status as victims. Men not only work longer and harder, they are much more likely to choose work that puts them in physical danger, exposes them to the elements, shortens their lifespan, and increases the level of job-related stress. These jobs, as a rule, pay better. It is the increased wages of risk and hardship. And the fact that more men than women choose to do these jobs is not a matter of discrimination, except to the extent that we still socialise men much more than women to put themselves on a chopping block for a paycheck. And this illustrates the concept of Farrell's seldom mentioned when discussing matters of pay, inequity and glass ceilings, the glass cellar. At the very bottom of the employment ladder are the death jobs: police work, firefighting, construction, truck driving, commercial fishing, manual labour and other jobs that form the backbone of our civilization. They are also the most dangerous and life-diminishing professions imaginable. All of them are as male-dominated as the halls of power. And they point to something that many may not want to hear. Pay equity for women is found not in boardrooms and corner offices, but behind the wheels of a semi, driving 40 tons of steel through icy weather in winter. Inclusion and parity is in the blistering hands that hold shovels and hammers in our minds, in the oceans and seas, labouring like a dog in unthinkably cold and 50-foot swells to bring the fish home to the table. In facing down sociopaths with knives in the darkened back alleys of our dense and decaying cities. These realities call upon us to examine a truth that many don't want to utter in today's politically correct culture, but is a truth nonetheless. If you want to get paid like a man, you have to work like one. Sometimes real justice is a real surprise, and equality a simple step up to reality. Thank you for listening to The Truth and Reason. This is Amfortas, and I thank my colleague Paul for his fine words. This podcast and video have been made in collaboration with Christian J for One for All. I dedicate it to my estranged but beloved daughter and to my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. Ask, who does the Grail serve?
And there you go. That's part three, which was Wages of Spin. I'm sure that's a bit of an eye-opener to many that are listening. And it just goes to show that, you know, you get these results from surveys and studies, etc., and you take them at face value. But, you know, when you really look into it and read into it and find out how they came to get those sorts of information, it's certainly a different story altogether. So with that, I was just on the internet, and I was having a look at the 9MSN homepage, and on there there was a piece about 10 things that women are better at men or better than men at. So I thought I'd just share it with our listeners and give you something to think about. And, you know, this is every single day these sorts of things are on various websites. As I said, this is the 9MSN website, and it's a link to the wonderful magazine Cosmopolitan. Okay, the 10 things that women are better than men at. Women are better drivers, apparently. More men are involved in fatal road accidents. Women live longer. 80% of people over 100 are women. Women are better communicators. 20,000 words per day versus 7,000 words per day. Women are better at adapting. Women eat healthier. Number six, they're better managers, better listeners, and they multitask. Seven, stronger immune systems fighting off disease. Eight, better at seeking comfort. 53% of women seek comfort from their friends, 29% of males. Better at evolving. Women are better at evolving than men, and apparently this all comes down to the fact that some study shows that they are getting better looking as each generation passes. And the last one, more recession-proof. Women are more recession-proof. Apparently 80% of redundancies since December 2007 were men. And with that, I think we'll go to a track from Brian Ferry.
Where have you been, my blue-eyed son? Where have you been, my darling blue? A stumbling at the side of the twisted mountains. What's in the corner, six crooked highways. Stuck in the middle of seven set forests. Been out in front of a dozen big oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of the graveyard. It's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard.
drums, Paul Thompson. On bass guitar, John Redden. In the horn section, we have Chris Mercer, Martin Drover, Mel Collins. On guitar, Chris Belling.
To our final segment. Just further on that Cosmopolitan thing that I was just mentioning before on the website 9MSN, you know, doesn't it all come down to personal stuff? Like, aren't some of us better at things than others? And, you know, it doesn't matter whether we're a man or a woman or whatever, you know, like some of us are better communicators than women. I know certainly some women that just don't want to talk about the stuff that really matters. You know, and, you know, I could go on and on and on. Stronger immune systems. Well, isn't that a very personal thing? You know, it's just spin. It is absolute spin. You know, and I guess this is really what Amphitaz is trying to bring around, is that, you know, there's lots of information out there, but a lot of it's spin. We'll go on to his last one. This is called Domestic Violence.
The truth is out there somewhere. I'm bringing you this sequel to the two-part podcast made by my colleague Amphitaz, in which he discussed the deliberate lying about domestic violence in Australia. Amphitaz showed how the Office for the Status of Women deliberately bullied the ABS, the Australian Bureau of Statistics, into putting its name to a bogus and appallingly biased survey. It was called the Women's Safety Survey, released in 1996, which was manipulated to repeat the ridiculous feminist claim that one in four women are victims. It was an advocacy research to prove their preconceived ideas. It was not simple statistical incompetence, but deliberate corruption. As a result of that bogus survey, women feared walking in the street, especially at night. Every husband was regarded as a potential wife beater. Funds flowed to the women's groups. Domestic violence advocacy was the fastest growing industry of the decade, employing thousands in the jobs for the girls paid from taxpayers' expropriation. Well, it took 10 years more for the ABS to manage to do a more reliable examination which tried to show the truth. At least it didn't leave out an entire gender this time. Once again, however, the feminist managed to interfere and manipulate, and in this podcast details how. It also shows how you can delve into the data collected to bring the truth into the light of day. The ABS Personal Safety Survey finally emerged in 2006 and sampled both genders for a change. Along with its appearance, the statistical myths and fabrications of feminist victimhood and women's class oppression and claims of an epidemic of violence against women were able to be immediately exposed and contradicted. The silence was deafening. Have you heard of the Personal Safety Survey and its finding? No. What a surprise. Heard of one in four women are victims? Of course you have. The silence didn't last long, of course, as it was soon replaced with a $73 million government advertising campaign based on the false results appearing on TV sets nationwide. It was like sticking fingers in women's ears and having them chant, "Men bad, women victims." The survey reveals a picture of what any rational person should have assumed about life simply by observation of the world around them and their day-to-day existence in it. The survey reveals what most people should have known or should have suspected about the facts of social violence. It is men rather than women who have the most to fear regarding their personal safety. It further reveals that the perpetrators of violence, in all their ugly forms and diversity, are not just men, and that the domain of perpetrators includes a significant percentage of women. There are a few surprises in this survey, other than it seems to have been conducted with appropriate propriety and adherence to statistical principles, almost a refreshing breath of fresh air, given the lies and spin of so many preceding studies and surveys conducted on the subject. But before delving into some of its facts and figures, there are a couple of points that should be clarified about the survey itself. As surveys go, it seems to have been done fairly responsibly, but with some clear prior interference. It has encompassed a sizable sample of the population, 16,300 adults in total, about 0.1% of the Australian adult population. So its findings could be seen to be a reasonable reflection of what's really going on in Australia today. That's 2.5 times the sample size of the feminist survey. However, for some reason, you'll instantly recognise nearly 3 times as many women were surveyed than men. 11,800 women compared to only 4,500 men. What a surprise. The feminists just cannot help themselves, can they? Men's experience of personal safety are not deemed as valid as those of women. Did they expect that women's experiences of violence would be more valid, diverse, or significant? Or was it simply a matter of funding, as it implied in the survey's notes? Funding controlled by feminists in the bureaucracy. You get the report. Read it carefully. Make up your own mind. Whatever the reason for it, there is no fair or justifiable stance that could possibly be taken for this glaring discrepancy. The question remains, why were men relegated to being less than second-class respondents? No one has provided an answer. You can go figure it for yourself, but perhaps we can hope this imbalance will be addressed in any further surveys where the sex of the respondents is relevant. For now, though, when digesting the results, it must be understood that sample distribution bias exists. In fact, in some cases, reflected in the ABS table, annotations have been made indicating that the data are of questionable reliability. Why would that be? Why would the ABS warn about its own data? I'll tell you in a moment. Given the importance and far-reaching social implications of this survey, this restriction of men's experience is a travesty of their rights as taxpayers and citizens of the nation. Especially as it turns out that men are singly the most severely affected members of society where personal safety and violence are concerned. This treatment of men is a clear statement by the government that they see Australian men as being second class and less important than the women of the nation. Yet, in the Liberals' defence, they had achieved government by then. It must be argued that they are the first and so far only government in Australia to include men in such a survey at all. Previous Labor governments, which had presided over the totally bogus Women's Safety Survey, simply didn't care about the safety of men and only ever conducted surveys for women. This development in itself is at least some consolation for Australian men and was a positive step forward. Now, the reason for the annotated questioning of the reliability of the data, especially about the men, you see, the other glaring concern about the production of this ABS survey was the sexist exclusion of men as interviewers. 100% of the interviewers were conducted by women. Only women, no men, by order of the feminist bureaucracy. It is important to realise that by using only female interviewers, it is likely to have led to an under-reporting of spousal and partner violence against men by females and an over-reporting of men's violence against women. In a national survey of this significance, one could have at least expected squeaky clean adherence to equal-sex political correctness. Pig's ass. Despite these sexist anomalies, the survey reveals for the first time much important information about personal safety and the victims and perpetrators of personal violence. It is a subject which has long been obscured by the murky fog of feminist advocacy. Prejudice and proving prior expectation have ruled such research. But against the odds, this survey has revealed and has exposed the feminist lies. The following statements derived directly from the ABS survey are just our initial findings, and a fuller investigation by listeners of the finer details is encouraged. I will compare the freshly published data to the often quoted rhetorical statistics of feminist propaganda. And remember this, these are official Australian government research figures and not some trumped up, biased, ideological, prejudiced university women's studies data or those of some politically or gender biased NGOs. Fact, the ABS survey has revealed that men are more than twice as likely as women to be the victims of violence and are being physically or sexually assaulted or threatened at a rate of up to 2 incidents per second. Women are not the victims of family violence as often as quoted 1 in 4, nor even 1 in 10, nor even 1 in 20, but actually 1 in 50. Women are not being raped or sexually assaulted every 26 seconds, nor even every 90 seconds, as feminists frequently claim, but are in fact experiencing rape hardly at all, and even when combined with the lesser sexual assaults, at a rate of 91% less than that which feminists have previously claimed. And this includes both reported and unreported incidents. The ratio of female versus male family domestic violence victims in a home is not 99 to 1, nor is it 75 to 1, nor is it 50 to 1, but it is actually closer to 2 to 1. These statements above are all calculated from the ABS survey data without corruption. They are the figures. Of course, there will be some deviation from the survey compared to real-life figures, just as in all studies. Also, read the fine print of the surveys, but remember nearly 3 women were interviewed for every 1 man. The data for men may have been tainted by the use of only female interviewers, some of whom may even have been staunch feminists. Show me a woman who claims she isn't. And together with a sample number bias, resulting in underreporting of men's experience of family violence as victims. Let us look closely at some of the other interesting statistics. During the previous 12 months in Australia, that is in 2005, 6.5% of males were physically assaulted and 3.1% of females. That is 1 in 15 men compared to 1 in 32 women. Conclusion, women are safer. attempted or threatened physical assaults were against 5.3 of males and 2.1 of females. Conclusion, women are 2.5 times safer than men are. Women can expect greater safety than men can. There isn't a bogeyman down every dark street looking for a woman to assault. The bogeyman is too busy assaulting men. In the sexual assault area, beloved of feminists and a source of fright, alarm and horror, and endless expropriated taxes for the agitprop, the survey indeed finds the figures swing to women being more likely to be sexually assaulted than men are. But the figures are lower still. Not a 1 in 4 women, not 25% as reported in the bogus women's safety survey. It is just 1.6% reported being sexually assaulted. Did you hear that? 1.6, that is 1 in 62, not 1 in 4. And men are sexually assaulted too, 0.6%. Threats and attempts at sexual assault are even lower, 0.5 for women, 0.1 for men. 97% of women are perfectly safe and not even under threat of sexual assault. Sexual assault on women and even on men is very, very low. Not that such a fact makes headlines in the newspapers. It doesn't sell. It doesn't sell stuff like scented candles or soap in the body shop. Why are women being deliberately frightened by the government? You have to ask your MP. In conclusion, what does all this mean? It means that Australia as a nation is the first in the Western world to undertake a safety survey of adults' personal safety and violence based on the sex of the community. It has both massive and broad implications for social scrutiny and the politics of sex and violence. It stands as a precedent for further world development and application. It also has immediate application to other Western societies. Australia, being a contemporary Western nation, has been subjected more or less to the same political influences over the last half century that have been experienced by the USA, the UK, Canada, New Zealand, and arguably most other European nations. The data recorded would be directly applicable to other Western societies, more or less, and may even be quoted as being from a highly reputable source. The result of this survey should be seen as the first authoritative sample of non-advocacy research on the issues of Western social violence and, in particular, intersexual personal violence. The result are both revealing and deeply informative. Revealing about the incorrectness of previously published feminist advocacy research and subsequent government information too. And informative about the dire state of violence perpetrated against men in modern civilised Western societies. The data also provides the basis for a requirement for Western governments to become focused on the safety standards of its men as a top priority and to begin to recognise that there are serious deficiencies in its treatment of men in society. The survey also amplifies the ludicrous state of Western government's pursuit of highly expensive anti-violence campaigns and legislation for the least affected victims of personal violence, women. Whilst a much more serious problem of violence exists and is being waged against its men, it is also established fact that require governments and anti-male NGOs in Australia to immediately rewrite the literature and websites which state false and misleading statistics about personal violence. Men are overwhelmingly family violence perpetrators. They are not. The data shows clearly that in the home, in the family, 98.5% of men are safe, law-abiding, indeed loving, protective and caring husbands and fathers. Should also lead to an immediate nationwide reassessment of family relationship management and family law values. But don't hold your breath. It's no wonder that feminists, the government, the mainstream media in Australia has been so quiet about the release of this new survey. It exposes a huge raft of feminist baloney, lies and deception. The silence also shows that the government is deliberately frightening women. The government wants women to be frightened of men. And the media is in the government's pocket. Yes, the truth is out. And out there, somewhere. But have you seen it? Have you heard it? You have now. This has been Christian J bringing it to you.
And that's today's show. Thank you for joining us today. If you want to hear the show again or if you've missed anything, you can download the show on www.dadsontheair.net. I'm Phil York from Dads in Distress. We'll see you all next week.
We ask no requests.